House Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, March 6th, 2007. Many members, we have a work session on one bill and then public hearing on three Senate bills. I will open the work session on House Bill 2092. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2092 concerns the ability of a service member parent to delegate parenting powers to a spouse while in active service. This committee first heard this bill on January 19th, and there were a few concerns that it only concerned parents and not when a service member shares custody with a different individual. And there was some concern that the language is a little bit vague about the length of the delegation. And so there were amendments sent down which have been returned, and the amendments specify that a service member can delegate this type of authority when the service member shares joint custody with a parent or another individual. And it also clarifies that the period of delegation shall not exceed the term of active duty plus 30 days unless the court finds that the delegation would not be in the best interest of the minor child. So the amendments just sort of clarify. I don't think it changes the workings of the statute in any way. But
okay, members, any questions about or comments about the Dash 1 amendments you see before you? I realize it's been a number of weeks since this bill was up for hearing, and actually a couple of us were excused that day, so this is our first exposure to the bill, but it looks pretty straightforward. That is, particularly with these revisions, so that it includes the case where somebody other than the other parent has the joint custody arrangement and has the safeguard of giving some discretion to not allow this if there's a situation such as a drug affected other parent, a spouse that would be not in the best interest of the child. So if there are no questions or comments, is there a motion?
I move the dash ones in 2092.
Representative Barker moves the dash ones into House Bill 2092. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The dash ones are in. Is there a motion on the bill?
I move House Bill 2092 dash one to the floor with a due pass.
I think this raises issues that I think would be appropriate to have a little presentation on the floor. So that would be my suggestion. Representative Barker moves House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Wisnett.
I think the committee just needs to thank General Caldwell for making himself available, although we will not need him today for this.
Yeah, absolutely. General Pitt, I should appreciate the Vice Chair Wisnett noting your presence in the hearing room today. We appreciate you coming out and bringing this bill forward. This is, I think, good legislative action on our part, and we appreciate the service that your people put in for our state and our country. any other discussion? I guess hearing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Hoff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 2092 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Reed, have you carried a bill from our committee yet this session?
I don't believe I have.
Why don't you carry this one?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2092 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 268. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 268 provides that a court does not have jurisdiction to review an order of the Workers' Compensation Board if the party seeking review fails to serve the petition on all adverse parties within the time limit for filing the petition. The bill also clarifies that the board has jurisdiction to enter a settlement order even if a petition for review is pending before the Court of Appeals. The bill allows a court to dismiss the petition if the parties settle the case.
We have Jim Nass signed up. Mr. Nass, could you come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. We bring you Senate Bill 268, mostly to make some technical fixes. First of all, as you may recall, back many, many years ago, workers' compensation cases used to go to circuit court before they came up to our court. Generally, when that happens, it's called an appeal. On the other hand, when we review a decision of an agency, we usually call that judicial review. Unfortunately, when we made the conversion of workers' compensation cases going to the Workers' Compensation Board before coming to our court, we didn't go back and clean up the language. So part of what this bill does, it just simply does some cleaning up of language so that review of Workers' Compensation Board decisions will now be called a judicial review. The second thing that the bill does is that it fixes an error that was made a number of years back. On page 2 of my written testimony, there is a list of all the things that are required under ORS 656-298 subsection 3 to initiate judicial review of a Workers' Compensation Board decision. That statute at that time did not say which of those were jurisdictional and which were not. That is, which of those, if you failed to do them, would result in dismissal of the case and which ones didn't. As a result, in some cases, we were getting essentially frivolous motions to dismiss for some minor failing. On the more serious side, many workers' compensation cases involve multiple parties, but as the case wends its way from the administrative law judge to the Workers' Compensation Board, then to the court, those bodies resolve issues and certain entities, employers, or their insurers essentially drop out of the case. Technically, they're still parties, so they still have to be served. What was happening is that we were seeing cases in which an employer or insurer who really had no real interest left in the case was not served timely, but under the statute we had to dismiss the case. So what we did a number of years back is amend that statute to try to do two things. That is, to make jurisdictional timely filing of the judicial review and timely service on those adverse parties who were real parties in interest, both of those to be done in a timely fashion, that is within 30 days of the date of the board order. Unfortunately, when the wording was drafted to do that, we ended up separating the service requirement from the timeliness requirement. Or at least so said the Court of Appeals in a case called Northwest Insurance Corporation versus Spivey. So what happened back in, I think it was in 1997, is that we mistakenly separated the service requirement from the timeliness part. So one thing that this bill hopes to do is fix that. The third thing the bill does is often when cases are on judicial review, they end up settling. Any settlement of a workers' compensation board case has to go back to the workers' compensation board to approve the settlement. The board takes the position that it does not have jurisdiction to act on the settlement while a case is pending on judicial review. So what happens now when parties settle, they have to ask us to dismiss the case, send it back to the board, hope the board approves the settlement and take the risk that if for whatever reason the board fails to approve the settlement, they're out of their judicial review. The way we try to deal with that now is that our orders of dismissal say that if the board should fail to approve the settlement, the party can come back to the court and ask to reinstate it. But the party takes the risk that if something goes wrong and the board fails to act on the settlement and we don't reinstate, whoever originally sought review is out of luck. So what the third thing that this bill would do is confer jurisdiction on the Workers' Compensation Board to act on settlement claims while the case is on non-judicial review. If the board approves the settlement and that settles the whole case, then we would dismiss the case without risk to anybody. If the settlement only settled part of the case, then the judicial review would go forward on whatever issues had not been settled. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nass, it'd be helpful for me and maybe for other members of the committee just to understand the context. And in a workers' compensation case, we know that the injured worker or claiming to be injured worker is a party. Who are the other parties? I heard a reference in your remarks earlier to an insurer. I think under some circumstances and maybe all circumstances, the employer of the worker at the time of the injury would be a party. Who are all the parties?
Mr. Chair, in the most simple workers' compensation case, if you have, let's say, a self-insured employer, you'll have two parties. You'll have the claimant and the employer. At the next level, most employers have workers' compensation insurers, and they become parties to a case when a claim is made while that insurer is on the risk. So probably the most common type of workers' compensation claim is a claimant, an employer, and insurer. Sometimes employers change insurers, and you can have an occupational disease claim that may have accrued over a period of time, including the time when the employer changed insurers. And so in that case, you have two insurers and one employer, one claim. So you're up to four now. Worst possible case, asbestos exposure or things like of that sort, where the exposure that may have caused the disease happened over a period of years during which the claimant worked for, let's say, three different employers, some of whom were self-insured, some of whom had insurers, and some of whom had multiple insurers. You can actually end up with seven or eight parties on the other side. As I said, oftentimes how these cases work is at the initial hearing level, the evidence will make clear that, say, that the very first employer and its insurer is definitely off the hook, that there's no way that whatever the employee experience there could have caused what the worker has. And so that party, they technically remain party, but they no longer have any interest because the ruling has made clear that they're off the hook. So let's say that the case then goes to the Workers' Compensation Board because someone's not happy with the administrative law judge's decision, and the board decides that it is a compensable claim and that a particular employer and its insurer is on the hook for the claim, so that the only issue left, let's say, is how disabled is the person. Well, by the time you reach the Court of Appeals level, the only people who care anymore are the claimant and the insurer who has been found to be liable for the claim. So out of this original cast of maybe 8 or 9 or 10 parties, you're down to 2 or 3. And what we tried to do back in 1997 is make clear that it's only timely service on the parties whose claims are still at risk are the only ones that you absolutely have to timely serve in order to get jurisdiction. You still have to serve the others, but if you mess up and fail to serve them timely, you won't have lost your case.
But the consequence of failing to serve them timely is that you would, your case would be gone. That is, I mean, if you're an injured worker, for example, and a decision is made by the board against you, and then and you want judicial review of that decision, but if you fail to timely serve, not only to give notice of appeal to the court, but to give service on all adverse parties from that proceeding, then you could be out of court, and you would have no remedy at that point. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, prior to 1997, that was true. You had to serve every single party timely, or you were out. What we tried to do in 1997 is to provide a little bit of relief from that, so that if the petition for judicial review identified who the true adverse parties were, and if the petitioner timely served those parties, we would have jurisdiction of the case, even if a mistake was made and there was a failure to serve timely one of these other parties whose interest has kind of dropped out of the case. That's what we were trying to do, and that's comparable to what we do in appeals from courts of law, where you can have many, many, many parties oftentimes. About probably 15 years ago, we fixed that statute so that in an appeal from a court of law, you only have to timely serve those parties that the appellant has designated as adverse parties on appeal. And so what we tried to do here is model that legislation and say same thing on judicial review of a workers' compensation case. If you designate who the adverse parties are and you timely serve those, your judicial review will go forward even if you made a mistake in serving some of the other parties.
So what change in that respect? I mean, it looks to me like the effect of this bill is to make it tougher to perfect your claim, your request, your petition for judicial review. That is, you not only have to get the petition to the court, but you have to get in a timely manner serve all adverse parties as a result of this bill. I mean, that's one of the effect of that change. Is that right,
Mr. Chair? What happened in 1997, what we tried to make jurisdictional was two things: timely filing and timely service on the parties designated as adverse parties. Through a drafting error, what we did is that we separated the service requirement from the timeliness requirement. So under the current law, according to the Court of Appeals, you can get into the Court of Appeals by timely filing only. You don't have to timely serve anybody.
Right.
And historically, the two steps that have been considered the bedrock jurisdictional things that you have to do is timely filing and timely service of adverse parties. And we made a mistake in 1997 how we drafted that bill, and we separated those two things. So now we're trying to hook those two back up again.
Okay, so the policy choice was always that you had to both file the petition with the court and give timely service to adverse parties, but the words didn't accomplish that, and that was always the desired policy choice by the judicial department, and now it's to conform to that policy choice. Although I don't do enough appellate practice to know this, but I think you're telling us that, but please confirm that's true in just general civil litigation. If I have a lawsuit in circuit court and I lose that lawsuit and I want to appeal it to the Court of Appeals, I have to both file the appeal with the Court of Appeals and give service on the winner of that lawsuit to tell him I'm taking the appeal within the 30-day time period for an appeal. Is that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
That's right. Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to sort out the what was versus what should have been. What this Liberty Northwest versus Spivey case, did that hold that all you had to do was timely file your petition, and it didn't matter for jurisdiction of the court whether you served any of the adverse parties on time? Is that correct?
Well, what actually happened in that case is that the party seeking review failed to serve one of the adverse parties timely. We initially dismissed the case. That party came back to us and said, you should not have dismissed the case as to me, because if you carefully read the statute, you will see that the requirement to serve has been separated from the requirement to do so timely. And so it is not a jurisdictional defect to fail to serve an adverse party timely. And the majority, it was a 2-1 decision of a 3-member panel, the majority said indeed, while that may not be what the legislature intended, that's what the words of the statute say.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You may.
So, let me make sure if I can get this right. So if, because the party failed to serve that one adverse party, if this bill passes, the whole case would be dismissed because they didn't serve all adverse parties. It wouldn't be dismissed just as to that one adverse party who wasn't timely filed. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, under this bill, if this bill would pass, if someone seeking judicial review failed to serve one of the parties that had been designated as an adverse party on judicial review timely, then yes, we would dismiss the case. We wouldn't care about those who were not designated as adverse parties. If there was a failure to serve someone who was not identified as an adverse party, we don't care. They still have to be served eventually, but if they fail to serve them within the 30 days, that's not a jurisdictional defect. It's only the failure to serve those parties that the person seeking judicial review has designated as the adverse parties. It's the failure to serve them timely that historically has been considered a jurisdictional necessity.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, that's consistent with existing law then. In other, for example, administrative proceedings that go to judicial review, that you still have to timely file your petition for review, and you have to timely serve all designated adverse parties.
In appeals from courts of law, that is true. In many administrative reviews, that is true. I will say that under the Administrative Procedures Act, which many judicial reviews arise under, it is not clear whether the failure to serve an adverse party is jurisdictional.
Thank you.
We've often wondered why the Attorney General has not moved to dismiss judicial reviews where there has been a failure to timely serve the adverse party, but for whatever reason, that hasn't happened, so the court has not had an occasion to rule on whether it is a jurisdictional necessity.
Mr. Ness, I have a concern that in the more complex situations, I knew you were describing some fact patterns where you could have multiple parties, that it may not be clear who all the adverse parties are, and if the failure to serve any one of them, say to serve some but not others, not get all the adverse parties served, causes the opportunity for judicial review to be lost, that seems like a harsh result. Do you have anything to say that would be reassuring to me on that?
Mr. Chair, the person seeking review gets the opportunity when preparing the petition for judicial review to identify who are the adverse parties. Once the person takes that step, and let's say there are 8 parties to the case, the person seeking judicial review thinks only 1 or 2 of them really care about the issue that they're going to raise. So in that party's in that party's petition for judicial review, it will say the adverse parties on judicial review are XYZ employer and its insurer, Liberty Mutual, whatever. So long as the petitioner timely serves those two parties, the court has jurisdiction of the case, even if there are other parties to the case, and even if there's a failure to serve one of them timely. Now, I will say that if the petitioner fails to take that step and explicitly state who are the adverse parties, then they will have to timely serve everybody. But workers' compensation is a comparatively narrow field. You have the same lawyers who do many, many of these cases, so they understand that by taking the opportunity when drafting their judicial review to identify adverse parties and making sure that they serve those parties timely, they reduce the risk of their case being dismissed for that reason to almost zero.
What would happen if the party who's seeking judicial review just flat out clearly got it wrong as to who the adverse parties are? So they, let's say there were two insurers in the picture, and the injured worker loses before the board and identifies one of the two insurers and just through mistake fails to identify the other. They're both clearly adverse parties, and then does serve the one identified adverse party. Does anybody have any standing to have an opportunity to challenge the jurisdiction of the court based on that error?
Mr. Chair, it might be considered an oddity that a party who, it turns out, does have a real interest in the case would not have to be timely served. But what the original bill was predicated on the concept that so long as you designate at least one party as an adverse party and you timely serve that party, we have jurisdiction of the entire case and all the parties. That's why we enforce the requirement that everybody has to get served, because a party that was not identified as an adverse party says, hey, I want to be heard. This case is important to me. You may not realize it, but I've got it. I have an interest in this case. That party has the right to appear, file a brief, and argue the case. So the failure to serve somebody timely doesn't prejudice anybody. It's just that this is a mechanism for making it far more likely than not that the true adverse parties on judicial review will get timely service. And if you fail to serve someone who, at least at the front end, does not appear to have an interest, you won't lose your case for that reason.
Okay. Committee members, I have beaten this into the ground. Anybody have any questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nass.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 268 and open a work session on Senate Bill 268. Members, this is a technical bill, and the only aspects of it that I think raise any question are this service issue. It seems a little artificial that you can only have to identify one of potentially multiple adverse parties, and as long as you serve them, you're okay. But it is within the power of the litigant to do that. So I guess I'm satisfied that it's not troublesome. Any concerns on part of committee members?
Representative Flores. Mr. Chair, I don't have concerns. I think that because I had some limited experience in also doing some workers' comp cases, I think that what Mr. Nass indicated was that in the preparation of the documentation, the pleading practice, it actually up front does indicate the adverse parties that be set out. And so I think it's preserving rights for claimant. And I don't see that it's disallowing any other party's interests.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Krieger, those of us that aren't attorneys,
it's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
I would suggest that Mr. Nash be the one to write the floor speech in language that we all understand.
Well, I can certainly appreciate probably the sort of what seems like a highly artificial and technical set of issues. I'll tell you, jurisdictional issues on getting your appeals filed on time. I mean, that is the surest way to malpractice for an attorney, is to fail to get an appeal perfected on time. So it gets attorneys' attention when you set these things out.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that goes to exactly your question regarding supposing the claimant did not adequately address the adverse parties or identify them. That rests squarely on the shoulders of the attorney.
Well, that is right, but it also is within the... I mean, if there's an error in identifying the adverse parties, then that's an error that counsel for the party has committed. So you can't get caught in a situation, from what I'm understanding, where just by making the wrong judgment about who the adverse parties are and not identifying all of them, that then failing to serve one would prevent your appeal from going forward. Am I understanding that correctly, Representative Bonamici?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, that this bill addresses that situation. I don't think it does. I don't think it addresses what happens if you don't identify the correct adverse parties. I think it just deals with a service.
I think you're right. This bill does not address that. What I understood from Mr. Nass is that if you, as long as you, counsel to a party, as long as you serve all those you have identified as being an adverse party, that is sufficient to gain jurisdiction, even if you inaccurately overlook somebody.
That's my understanding.
Any further discussion?
No.
Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 268 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron has moved House Bill or Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I would invite, by way of discussion on that motion, whether people think that this is something that it would benefit from a presentation on the floor or not. I realize it's pretty technical stuff. I think there is an issue there. Is it something do you think our colleagues would want to hear more about?
Senator Chair, we've spent, 20 minutes, half an hour, mm-hmm. or more, trying to understand it with expertise here. I don't think 90% of the people on the floor are going to understand what we're trying to do and the reasoning behind it. Yeah. Even if you read the bill, you look at the staff summary report, I'm not certain what purpose it serves.
Okay, well, we'll take that as a suggestion that we place this on the consent calendar. Which it is, we did hear that it was conforming the law to what had been an intent formed several years ago.
Yeah.
So do I understand that to be part of your motion, Representative Cameron, to that it be placed in the consent calendar?
Well, I'll withdraw my motion and let Representative Krieger make his motion.
Okay, that works too?
Yeah, well, to move it to the floor of the due pass and put it on the consent calendar.
Yeah. The original motion was withdrawn, and Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion of that motion?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I am still sort of processing this, and I'm planning to vote for it, but with a reservation that if I read this case and learn something that changes my mind, I may change my vote on the floor. So does that mean that on the consent calendar you cannot?
I would say... I think if there's that concern, I think we ought not place it on the consent calendar. I think if there's any possibility that anybody has any concern about it and even might come to a different view on it, then I think it's not appropriate for the consent calendar. It's really only those things that we're...
That's my thinking, and I just want to think...
Just carry the bill.
Okay, we have two withdrawn motions.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll move that we send Senate Bill 268 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. And my colleague to my right might be the carrier.
Representative Cameron has moved Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Koff. Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 268 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Bonamici, could I ask this of you? If could you, if you become satisfied that the bill is will have your support on the floor, that you could be the carrier. But if not, then I will take it on for you.
Absolutely.
I think it's probably better to have somebody who's been through the legal mills to carry this one. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 268 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 269. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 269 primarily deals with statutory forms and family law actions. What we're talking about are forms that are written into the statute themselves. And what this bill does is it repeals those statutory forms and instructs the state court administrator to create forms and informational brochures that comply with the various family law statutes. It also requires the administrator to create a form allowing a party to seek a waiver or deferral of fees for the summary dissolution of marriage. It requires a party who petitions a court for summary dissolution to serve the petition and summons on the spouse, and requires the spouse to file a written answer within 30 days. Finally, SB 269 allows a court to find the spouse in default, enter a judgment for summary dissolution, and award costs if the spouse fails to answer the petition.
Okay, we have Ms. Sidlick from the Judicial Department.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, I am Melissa Sidlick. I'm family law staff counsel for the Oregon Judicial Department. And Senate Bill 269 is the department's proposal, as counsel stated, to remove the currently existing family law statutory forms that are in Chapter 107 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And then to replace those forms with the requirement that they be created as prescribed by the State Court Administrator's Office. Now, Chapter 107 is that portion of Oregon's laws that deal with dissolutions, separations, and annulments. And it by no means contains all of the hundreds of family law forms that exist in these types of cases. However, it does, or this chapter does contain five forms, and I've set those forth for you in my written testimony, two of which are very important and quite voluminous, the summary dissolution statute and forms, and the Family Abuse Prevention Act statute and forms. So you may not have noticed this, but this is a 34-page bill, and 24 of these pages are actually forms. So indeed, and most of these are the FAPA and summary dissolution forms. So they are indeed quite lengthy. This proposal actually parallels a longstanding recommendation of the Office of Legislative Counsel that where they exist, statutory forms be taken out and placed within the purview of an appropriate authority. And one of the obvious reasons is that during legislative session, and I've had this personal experience, it's extremely difficult to work on making substantive law changes and then at the same time design complete and accurate and user-friendly forms, particularly where they are long and complicated. It's been the department's experience that forms are best created as a process of legal research, pulling together stakeholders who might be using these forms, and then sending the forms out for review. And that's a much more time-consuming process than would be permitted during legislative session. The Oregon Judicial Department does have a family law website that has over 300 forms currently on it. So we are quite experienced in that area. And also having this past fall to our office would also mean that we could make corrections, we could make improvements without having to wait for another legislative session to make statutory changes. In addition, having these forms within the purview of the state court administrator means there will be greater consistency and accessibility statewide, and the greater likelihood that they could, providing funding exists, be translated into non-English languages. This bill has no opposition that I am aware of, and it passed the Senate by unanimous vote. And that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Seidlitz? I don't think I have any myself. So, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Ms. Seidlitz, other than appearing on the State Court Administrator's website, then, what would be other options to making the forms available and usable to provide the continuity and the uniformity, I think, that you're seeking?
Mm-hmm. Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, the statutory language for these forms actually requires that the local courts make many of them available in hard copy at their locations. So they would be available by hard copy at the court offices. In addition, individuals can go to local assistance, victim assistance offices, or to the local law library, and there is a fee involved for that, but download them. So they're available in a variety of ways. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Representative Kump.
Thanks, Chair McPherson. Just to follow up on your comment about translation, do you have a strategic plan? How many languages you possibly could provide, and what the timeline would be in 2 years, 4 years? Or?
Chair McPherson and Representative Kump, I'm probably not the appropriate person to speak to this. I believe the department has made a request for funding of translated forms in its budget package. And however, we have done it in the past through grants that have become available. And we have had at least the Family Abuse Prevention Act forms translated into Vietnamese, Korean, Spanish, Russian. I believe that's it.
Thank you.
Questions? Then hearing none, we'll excuse you, Ms. Seidlick.
Thank you.
That's the only witness we have signed up on Senate Bill 269. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 269 and open a work session on Senate Bill 269.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 269 to the floor with a due pass on the consent calendar.
Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 269 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Cox. Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reese.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 69 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 269 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 270. Councilman Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 270 allows an operator of a, quote, assistive communication device for a juror with a disability to be present during jury deliberations so long as the person does not participate in the deliberations except to facilitate communications between the jurors. The bill deletes the provision that requires the parties to stipulate and prepare jury instructions regarding the assistant's attendance during deliberations and instead requires the court to instruct the jury on the presence of that person. The bill declares an emergency is effective upon passage.
Okay, Nancy Cosine from the Oregon Judicial Department.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Cosine, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department in support of Senate Bill 270. I've provided written testimony, and I'll go ahead and summarize some of what's in that. Mr. Comanson appropriately and accurately summarized the bill. This was introduced at the request of the Judicial Department, and it does amend ORS 10-115 to allow a person operating an assistive communication device to be present during jury deliberations. Current law allows the presence of an interpreter, qualified interpreter, to assist a person with a disability and prohibits the interpreter from participating in the jury deliberation process. This bill would expand that same permission and limitation to persons operating assistive communication devices. It would also require the court to instruct the jury so that the jury understood the limited role of the qualified interpreter or the person operating the assistive device. And it would also update the code to use person-first language. So instead of referring to a disabled juror, it would be a person with a disability. In terms of background information, the Oregon Judicial Department is substantially committed to ensuring that people with disabilities can participate fully in the court process and in the jury process. We formed a task force with the Oregon State Bar, and that task force on access to state courts for persons with disabilities came out with recommendations. We also, the Oregon Judicial Department, did a comprehensive analysis of our current compliance with the federal ADA to ensure that we were in compliance with that and other stricter standards that are currently in statute in Oregon. It's possible that some of the recommendations in Senate Bill 270 are already required by federal law, but passage of 270 would ensure that our statutes are up to date. We are also committed to the integrity of the jury process, and we construe construe ORS 10-115 very strictly regarding the confidentiality of juror deliberations. It would be very helpful to have the language specifically allowing assistive communication device operators to be present in the room. Some devices that are currently available is the CART device, which is computer-assisted real-time captioning. We've tried to draft the bill broadly enough to capture something that might be available in the future. The people that operate CART are not qualified interpreters, but they're just as important when it comes to enabling a person with a disability to participate in the jury deliberations. Senate Bill 270 was unanimously passed on the Senate floor. And after receiving a due pass recommendation from the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm available for any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cosine. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The I don't know anything about the technology of that, but is that like what I see on TV when I'm reading closed captions when they're doing instantaneous? I mean, and I see sometimes there'll be a word, I mean, it'll be wrong. It'll get that wrong just in the quick translation.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, I am going to defer that question, if it's all right, to Leola McKenzie, who is present in the room. She was on the task force and is very familiar with the technical details of CART and other.
And Ms. McKenzie, if you could start by identifying yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Leola McKenzie. I'm the Acting Director for CART Programs and Services Division for the State Court Administrator's Office. Representative Barker, the computer-aided relay transcription is consistent to what you would see on television.
So I don't know how that works. I guess it doesn't matter how it works because it does work, but I didn't know if they were doing like, if that somebody does like court reporting and then it translates that real quick, or how does that?
Yeah, what they usually have is a computer monitor available for the person who is deaf or hard of hearing, and a captioner is typing in exactly what's being said, and it's showing up on a monitor for the other person.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cosine, I have a question about the jury instruction portion on page 2 of the bill. I'm just curious about why the language is being taken out saying that the party shall propose instructions with respect to the interpreter to new language, it says the court shall instruct the jury on the presence of the qualified interpreter or person operating an assistive communication device. Are you suggesting that there be just some sort of standard instruction on this, but the parties will still prepare it, won't they?
I'm going to defer one second.
Yes, we're taking the language out. I'm sorry, Representative Bonavici. We're taking the language out because we believe that it conflicts with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The judge would still work with the parties to do the instructions for the jury and for the interpreter on what their behavior should be like in the jury deliberation room.
Follow-up, please.
You may.
I was just confused about why we were taking out the requirement that the parties prepare proposed instructions versus the court shall instruct the jury. So who's going to prepare the parties still prepare the jury instructions, is that correct?
Yes, the parties would prepare the jury instructions. However, the language that we're taking out is that they need to stipulate to the person being in there because a person with a disability has a right to have an appropriate accommodation.
Thank you. That part I understand.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 1, section 1, paren 3, we talk about the oath or affirmation shall be administered to a qualified interpreter appointed for a juror with a disability. In substance, that the interpreter will accurately communicate the proceedings to the juror and accurately repeat the statements of the juror. What are the provisions that would require, excuse me, the confidentiality of that person acting as the interpreter so as not to communicate the deliberations of the jury?
Representative
outside the jury room.
Representative Flores, the provisions would be included in subsection 5 there where it talks about instructing the juror on the presence of the qualified interpreter or the person using the assistive communication device and the instructions that the parties and the judge would give to the jurors as well as the interpreter.
Follow up.
You may.
So you're pointing to subsection 5, and the jury instructions would not bind necessarily that person acting as the interpreter, would they, to the same confidentiality or that the juror has? Or is that the intent? And I'm not reading it clearly.
Representative Flores, that is the intent. Jurors, excuse me, qualified interpreters have codes of ethics that they're responsible for living and working by when they're in their interpreting capacity. And the instructions that would be delivered to the jurors as well as the interpreter would require them to continue by their code of ethics and to keep things that are said in the jury deliberation room confidential.
Thank you.
I have a question which doesn't really go to the substance of this bill, but all of these services, both the interpretation service that's already it's not being affected by this bill and the operator of assistive communication device, are those services or functions that we pay for through our judicial budget in order to provide access to people who need those services?
Representative McPherson, yes, they are. They come out of our mandated budget lines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so the effect of this bill, which is to move the person operating the assistive communication device, they're already in the courtroom assisting the person who needs that service to be able to understand the proceedings that they're serving as a juror on. What this bill does is it moves them into the jury deliberations as well. And I don't see any fiscal on this, but I'm assuming that that's as compared to the amount of time spent in in the courtroom itself, that this is not something that has any significant fiscal impact to adding them in, bringing them into then the jury deliberations?
Representative McPherson, that is correct. Currently, we believe that many courts are allowing these people already to go into the jury deliberation room under the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there are already services that are being paid for.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, then thank you, Ms. Cosine and Ms. McKenzie. Appreciate your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 270 and open a work session on Senate Bill 270.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee pass Senate Bill 270 to the floor. We'll do pass recommendation on a consent agenda.
Representative Wisnett has moved Senate Bill 270 to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Forrest.
Perhaps I could just ask for some additional clarification, because in reference to my question about the confidentiality instruction to the qualified interpreter, we were pointed to subsection 5 where it says that a juror with a disability serves on a jury trial, and the court shall instruct the jury on the presence of the qualified interpreter or person operating on an assistive communication device. So that's simply an instruction that there's that extra person there, but it does not seem to reach to the extent of giving that person serving in that capacity the same type of instruction of confidentiality. So I just have a little bit of a check mark there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I was also questioning the reference to Section 5, but then I looked at Section 4, where it says that the interpreter or person operating an assistive communication device may not participate in the jury deliberations in any manner except to facilitate communication between the juror with a disability and the other jurors or other persons with whom the jurors may communicate, and the court shall so instruct the jury and the interpreter. And I think that maybe that's where the requirement comes in, that the court is also instructing the interpreter, that the interpreter's role is limited to facilitating the communication. And I think implicit in that is limiting the interpreter's role to not go out and have a press conference or something about the deliberations. But I think that may address your concern.
And I appreciate that focus. I'm not sure it does address my concern, but if we feel that that catches and embraces that whole issue, then I'll stand aside.
Representative Wisnett.
Chair, thank you. Representative Flores, I took the comments from our testimony that that's part of the code of these people are certified, and part of their certification is that they have that responsibility not to do that, and that solved it for me.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. I certainly appreciate that, but I don't see that addressed here.
Well, I think there's a broader issue there that would exist for interpreters as well as for the people operating the assistive communication device, which is what are their obligations as to confidentiality about what they observe or hear in the jury room. And I'd have to say, confess that I'm just a little fuzzy on even what the duties of the jurors are after they've completed their deliberations. You see these tell-all books that are written by people on high-profile juries at times. I'm not sure that they're violating a standard
or not.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we should have that clarified because, as the justices have come here and said, if you don't say it, we're not going to add it in there for you. So maybe we need to have language that clearly says that they have to be instructed in that. I think Representative Flores is right. It doesn't say that. And so we're assuming it does, but we're kind of taking a leap of faith there.
Yeah. Now, we would have... within the scope of this bill, because the relating to clause is relating to jurors with disabilities, we couldn't really do anything with respect to the people who are doing and providing interpretation services, because it would be, I think, outside the scope of what this bill, the relating to clause in this bill. So we could put a put language in that would restrict communication by the people who are providing assistive communication services to disabled jurors, but I think probably not people who, because we couldn't say that somebody who doesn't speak English is disabled. So I think there's another kind of connected issue here, which is confidentiality by both classes of individual who are being allowed into the jury room, interpreters who are there now, and now operators of assistive communication devices. And the question is whether we should be trying to address that issue as part of this bill. And actually, Council Commons, why don't you express more broadly the comment that you've whispered to me about the... I have this impression that actually there isn't, after the jury has completed its deliberations, there's no duty of confidentiality as to what was discussed in the jury room. Is that a correct impression?
Yeah, that's right. Jurors can generally talk about what happened afterwards, and you've seen books, you know, the OJ trial and things. Judges can restrict attorneys from talking to jurors, but generally jurors can speak about what happened. And as far as putting in something in here within the relating clause, I think you could add something that just says, if you're talking about the instruction, that as long as it relates to the right of a juror to have a disability, and a part of that right is, well, the person who's coming in with you has to be, you know, keep quiet. I think you could probably do that if you wanted to.
Thank you, Council, for that clarification. And I think it's fairly clear that once a trial has ended, that requirement for confidentiality has ended as well. And that's not the focus of my concern. The focus of my concern is that if this is a protracted proceeding and they are coming and going for a number of days, that provides the opportunity for that breach of confidentiality, and I don't see that that's provided for in here for those individuals serving as assistance to those with disabilities.
Ms. Kozian is looking anxious. I think we should have her come forward, you know, during our work session to try to help guide us here.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Jurors are instructed during deliberations that everything is to be kept confidential. Currently, the qualified interpreters receive the same instruction. They are also required to keep things confidential. I don't have that statute with me, and I don't. I apologize for that. I'd be happy to get that for you, but I'm confident that the jury deliberations are a private matter. The Judicial Department takes that very seriously, and we ensure that all of the deliberations are kept private.
Committee members, this is a Senate bill, so this is on a fast track, and it's not as though there's any pressure at this point in the session to be moving this thing along. If people would feel more easy about this bill, we could close our work session and gather that fuller information about confidentiality and bring it back at another day, if that would help. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I was all ready to move the bill, but just brought up an interesting point. So it's clear that there's confidentiality during the actual jury deliberations.
Yes.
Counsel brings up a good point. Now I'm free as a juror to go out and publish a book or talk about things that happen afterwards. And I think it is important that there is a confidentiality that remains for the person who is assisting even afterwards, that they're not going to go out and share information about me or things that I said. And maybe that's clear in their code of ethics, but I guess I want to follow up on that afterwards, because now the jury's allowed to talk, but is the person who assisted still bound to confidentiality?
If I might comment.
Representative Flores?
I guess that's arguable, and that really isn't my focus, other than I think that then probably does take it to an area that maybe would not be in the purview of this bill. But I would certainly like to, as Ms. Kozian had indicated, like to see what the statute provision is for anyone in the jury room to receive those instructions.
Mm-hmm. Well, then what I would propose is that we not take action on the bill today and gather that information, and then we can bring it back at another day. So I'll close the work session on Senate bill. Oh, I'm sorry. Would you withdraw your motion? Or not?
Hit him with that gavel a couple times.
I want to be sure that it's on record. I'm supporting the people with disabilities, and they need to move this bill quickly, but I'll withdraw it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wilson. It is, as I pointed out, a Senate bill, and we are only on the 6th of March, so we've got plenty of time to take action on this bill, and it's obviously the core purpose, which is to provide assistance to our disabled jurors with disabilities who are serving on juries is something that we will certainly address. So thank you. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 270. That concludes our agenda for today, committee. We're adjourned.